From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up, UC Berkeley linguist Robin Lakoff has been a preeminent expert on gender and language for decades. Her new book, Context Counts, is a retrospective of her work and a collection of musings on topics ranging from gender to law and psychology. She'll join us to talk about the book and how political discourse has evolved over the course of her career. It's coming up next. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Influential, eminent UC Berkeley professor emerita Robin Lakoff has studied and written about linguistics for more than 40 years, and her latest book, Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power, assembles her key work with analysis from other linguists, early career essays, and personal reflections. She joins us this hour in studio to discuss Context Counts and to get her take on American political discourse under President Trump. And welcome back to Forum, Robin Lakoff.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Thank you. To have you. It's been a long time, too long. I remember many delightful conversations with you, particularly about language and how it's changed and people calling in with their pet peeves in language and so forth. And I want to talk with you, well, right straight away about something we talked about yesterday. I'll say the word once, shithole. There it is. It's a word.
Shithole. I can say it too.
Well, we'll say s-hole from now on. How's that? But it's a word that became identified with President Trump. Dick Durbin says he said it. Now there's a controversy. Others say he didn't say it or he said something else and so forth and so on. And so it goes. I'd like to read something from Francine Prose, a name you may recognize, who wrote on Facebook, "He's ruined the word s-hole for us forever. I'm stuck in some s-hole U.S. airport. No, I can't even think this place is an s-hole without thinking of him, which will make the experience of being stuck in this s-hole airport a million times worse. Thanks for this, too." Well, it's caused all kinds of responses, and it's an odd word. You know, do you think it's being certainly characterized largely as a racist word, and yet people use it all the time, like
the
airports.
The word itself wasn't racist, but the context in which it,
exactly.
You say, essentially, countries with a majority black population are this thing, then it becomes racist.
But in itself,
Did you see the cartoon, or the photo, actually, that apparently somebody projected atop the entrance to the Trump Hotel?
Yes,
projected
that
word. So that was a very accurate use of it, I think.
Well, the word has certainly multiple meanings in many people's minds. It's just one of those words, though, you wonder, you know, we're not supposed to use it according to FCC on the air and everything, but do evangelicals, I wonder, like hearing the president use a word like that? It's a profane word, really. The S word is profane.
Actually, scatological. People should make these distinctions more precisely. You know, even though I'm a recovering academic, I still have these tendencies to try to be precise. So there's profanity, which is what evangelicals wouldn't like. Fanum is Latin for temple, other things. So profane language is like hell and damn, words that have
better
to do.
Stop there, Robin. Yeah.
Am I allowed to?
No, I mean with other words that you don't have to cite. In other words, scatological meaning of feces, that's,
yes.
As opposed to
score
a profane
in
word.
Greek, score skatos is excrement.
Well, you know, Jeff Nunberg, a fellow linguist of yours, yes. Who is also in Berkeley, wrote a whole book on the a-hole word. And those words are really kind of descriptively pejorative words, and they have a lot of radiation effect.
Well, they frighten us. When someone uses them, they give us pause because, you know, we worry about just the shocking nature of them. Can we continue the conversation beyond this, because this has kind of stopped me mentally in my tracks. So they have an effect which has very little to do with their literal meaning. But, you know, there are people who know a well-timed asshole has all kinds of effects.
Well, you've studied the way people speak in so many different contexts, as you write about in your book here. And I saw a blog recently you did about Yiannopoulos, Milo Yiannopoulos, and the alt-right, and you say they talk in infantile, antisocial kind of language. Infantile is a strong word to use, but President Trump has actually, there's been a study of his vocabulary. It was printed in the Boston Globe, among many other places, that said he has a fourth-grade vocabulary.
Pretty much. And also his tendency to repeat and repeat is, you know, when you're just learning a language, you repeat a lot. It's how you learn it. And small children, because they have small vocabularies, they have to make the best use of them. And because they're learning them, they use a lot of repetition. But I'd say even more important than the words themselves in deciding what's infantile is his syntax. Syntax comes later in language learning, first language learning, than does the lexicon. And Trump, actually, you can say with some fairness that Trump has deficits at every point in the grammar, from phonology, how he, you know, bigly, his sounds, words, up through syntactic grammar, and ending with pragmatics, how it functions, what works and what doesn't, how to be polite. Oh, there isn't too much of that.
Or how to win.
Yeah, winning at all costs, but do you win? And I think he is not good at winning in the long run. But I think the most troublesome thing to me about Trump's linguistic deficits is that he lacks any semantic component, which is that part of the grammar that's about how you connect the word with the meaning, the sentence with the meaning. Very important. And I think, you know, everyone will say Trump is a liar. I mean, everybody I talk to anyway will say Trump lies. I think that's false. I think Trump never lies and never tells the truth either, because in order to be a liar or a truth teller, you have to be able to use semantics. You have to be able to say these words relate to this whatever that's going on outside of language in reality, you know, in the thought process. There are numbers of ways in which he either misuses or doesn't use semantics. And one is that it really doesn't seem to matter to him whether it's true or not true. It's just not there, that distinction.
Well, the big question is, does he know that, or is he so deceived in so many instances that he can't distinguish the truth from the false?
It kind of comes to the same thing. He just doesn't know. And I think you can tell that, you know, if you think about champion poker players, for instance, they understand tells. That's how they win.
Sorry to say, you're looking at one. I won a few tournaments in my day.
And so you know that you look at your opponents and you see, you know, are they squirming in their seat? Are they sort of smirking? Are they, blinking their eyes? Are they running their hands through their hair? I'm illustrating this, which does a lot of good under the radio. And he never does. He never does what a true liar would do. And this is very dangerous. It's more dangerous than if he were a true out-and-out liar, because you can catch liars by their tells. And when you do, you can shame them, at least sometimes. You can say, you were lying. I caught you lying. That is a lie. People do that with Trump. It doesn't matter in the slightest.
Is this syntactical similarities to people like Yiannopoulos or the rhetoric from the alt-right that you write about?
I think it's not dissimilar. I mean, it's again... what all this is using language to win in the moment. You know, I'll say anything I have to say to get you to like me or get you to fear me, whatever I want.
Or to sell my wares.
Or to sell my wares. You know, whatever works at this moment between you and me, and whatever consequences it might possibly have for the future, not my job, not my problem. This is the propagandist game, and it's very dangerous.
Talking with Robin Lakoff, Professor Emerita in Linguistics at UC Berkeley and author of Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power. Well, let's talk about language and power, and we ought to also say it's edited by Laurel Sutton. I mean, you've been working in this field for so long now and have written really, in many ways, seminal work.
Some people might argue with that.
Well, yeah, they might argue with the use of the word, too. It's a gender word, too. But, you know, I'm wondering about just what you say is a general morass and difficulty, the insoluble nature of this gender chasm that we have in language. And you write a lot about women being acclimated to be nice. Verbally aggressive is not the way ladies are supposed to comport themselves or speak, whereas men be bullies and strong and assertive and all that. Do you think with all these alpha girls we're reading about and all the rest of this change that's going place and Me Too and speaking out and so forth, that we've come to maybe a different fork in the road?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that Me Too, you know, continues and extends. And I hope that by learning that you can be out there and you can attack when you have to attack and you can be, yes, even aggressive when you have to be and be a woman, that we can eventually change a great deal of our linguistic practice, how women should talk, how men should talk, all of that, our expectations, our understanding of what women mean when women speak, as well as what men mean when they speak. I'm hoping if we could do that, you know, this gets well beyond sexual harassment and gender harassment. We have to go through that phase, but we must go further than that to really change something. And if we can really change our expectations of what it means to be a gendered person in this world, then we'll really have made progress.
Well, the idea, though, that you often write about is women should be soft, not grating. They should not be shrill. They should not speak authoritatively or necessarily powerfully. And they're doing that more now. I mean, certainly they're doing that in this movement.
We're learning. It's difficult for at least us older women who, you know, came up in a very different age. But, you know, you learn and you learn that, yes, there are penalties, but the penalties don't kill you. And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And you learn to dare. I think daring has a lot to do with it, certainly at first. And, you know, I notice that younger women are much less afraid than I was when I was their age. So
but there's still this divide between, you know, acting manly. I mean, it's a word that is so much a part of the lexicon, or acting feminine, acting ladylike. Those are still, I mean, even, I'm also curious to get some thoughts from you on just the use of words like boy and girl. I mean, girl has become almost prohibitive in referring to women because of the feminist movement. Boy, because of racial connotations, is certainly something that's not used. And men don't like to be called boys of any race. So that seems to me to speak volumes about how our language has evolved.
Well, girl is, as in recent years, had an interesting history. When I wrote Language in Woman's Place, girl really was a deprecatory term.
Yeah.
Kind of meant of women, you're not really mature, you're not grown up, we don't have to take you seriously. And therefore, I counseled against its use. But what's happened
since then,
it's changed,
hasn't it?
It's been reclaimed, at least to some degree, that girl is an expression of solidarity. You know, you go girl, and so on. That it can mean, you know, we are both not only women, but we're fighters. We are young and strong, and we can win. Boy, I think, is still problematic because a lot of men are afraid of dropping back in status to being only boys, not men. But, you know, you can take words back.
Although I have Jewish friends who call me boy chick, but that's a different word, I guess,
different.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
a diminutive of a different sort, more of an affectionate diminutive. What about all these sexual words that are used about sexual prowess or sexual activity? I'm thinking about the word womanizer, but you don't have manizer.
Exactly. No, manizer would be so bad you couldn't even have a word for it.
But there are words, I mean, I go way back to words like nympho or promiscuous, sexualizing words, slut would be the
slut
obvious
versus
example.
Stud. You know, it's a good,
versus stud or satyr or...
Yes.
Or player.
Which often have at least partly a positive connotation. You know, to call a man a stud is a term of admiration. Oh, look what he gets. Why can't I get that? Where to call a woman a slut is not nice. It's harmful and it's hurtful. And I think it's used on the internet a great deal to shut women up, put them in their place, which still exists.
What happened to words like trollop or strumpet? They're just gone.
Yeah, you could bring them back.
You think so?
Yeah, but trollop sounds like an author somehow.
It is. Anthony, we're talking to Robin Lakoff, and we're going to get you involved in this discussion. What about when President Trump, after Hollywood Access, says, it's just locker room talk? What did you make of that?
A couple of things. One, if you do it outside in the open air, you're not in a locker room. B, if you were in a locker room, it's still not a good way to talk about half the human species, essentially. I know that's been used as an excuse, but really, you know, imagine if you transferred it to a racial context. And instead of using the words that Trump used, you use racially disgusting words, and the language does have them. There would be such a hue and cry and hullabaloo and everything. And I don't think he could have won, despite everything, had that been what he was talking about. Because we are, fortunately and thankfully, very alert to racial slurs. But we kind of think that sexual slurs, boys will be boys, locker room this, you know, let it go. And that has to change.
What about a kind of political correct language that we have? And I'm interested in your thoughts on this because you're not supposed to say transgenders, for example. You can gays and lesbians, but you're not supposed to say, you're supposed to say transgender people. That's politically correct. You're not supposed to say colored people, but you can say people of color. How do these things evolve, do you think? I mean, the differentiation between what's correct or what's incorrect there.
It's hard. We live in tricky times. Well, okay, so I'll ask you. I've thought of this a lot. Would you rather be described as a Jew or Jewish?
Jew is too connotatively derogatory, I think. Yeah, I think so.
A lot of people will say, I'd rather be described as Jewish rather than a Jew.
I think most people would say that.
Yeah, because a Jew sounds like that's the only thing of interest that you are. The same thing has been going on about autism, that instead of saying, well, actually, it's a different thing. Instead of saying that person is autistic, you say
he's on the spectrum or she's on the spectrum.
Has autism. You kind of separate it. You separate the thing, which often has a negative connotation, from the person. So you can be Jewish or have autism or be of color. And that isn't the only thing that people need to know about you. So it's, and, you know, people talk about PC. I really wish that term would go away. I think rather than PC, we should see trying to talk this way as behaving courteously.
Civility.
Civility, exactly. Yeah. Why can't we be civil to one another? It would be a very good thing if we suddenly started behaving better toward people who weren't just like us.
One of the reasons, at least in terms of language and rhetoric, that people can't be civil, it's so argued. One of your students, you were the pioneer, and you were her mentor, Deborah Tannen, says, we're in an argumentative culture. Yes. Winning, again, is more important than truth. And
little did she know, I mean, when she wrote that, it wasn't a problem compared with what we have now.
You mean like alternative facts and post-truth
and all that?
Yeah,
much worse.
Well, it's still with us very much, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And so are a lot of words that, talking a little bit before we went on the air about words like awesome, you know, I mean, you think about awe, you think about, you know, something spiritual, something, you know, almost beyond human reckoning. And, you know, these French fries are awesome. We're hearing it. But that's, you've always been in favor of sort of going along with the changes in language. You can't avoid them, right?
Well, you can't avoid them. You may as well understand them. And part of, here we get into semantics again, one of the things that happens over the history of language is that words that were formerly very strong, when they're used a lot, they become weaker. Words that were formerly weaker when they get into new kinds of context, they become strong. So language meaning, both at the word level and higher up, are always shifting. And it makes it interesting for us. The fact that awesome doesn't mean today what it meant 200 years ago and quite possibly won't mean in 200 years, if it exists at all, what it means now, it's kind of fun. It keeps us alert. It keeps language on its toes and its users on our toes. So I don't mind.
Talking with Robin Lakoff, linguist Robin Lakoff, about language and power and language and gender and all kinds of things related to language, language in the politics of today. With President Trump, if you have questions or if you have comments, we welcome your involvement in the program. We'd like to hear from you. You can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Or if you have questions or comments, you can post them right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or feel free, of course, to post any questions or comments on our Facebook page. And Robin Lakoff's new book is Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power, edited by Laurel Sutton. This is kind of a retrospective, a whole...
Yes.
It's everything in many ways.
Yeah.
And what do you hope will be be the readership in this or what they'll get out of this?
I think I've always liked to think that what I write is available, accessible to other people than linguists. And I hope this will be. I do, you know, some of the papers get into all the linguistic turgidity, some, and I sort of wish, well, I don't know, I think you have to go through that. But some of it, I think and hope, is available to anyone who likes to think about language and what it does to and for us, and how the language choices we get to make affect some larger, deeper reality. So I think anyone could read at least some of it.
I think you're right, and I think one of your gifts has been explaining things to a lay audience, but also being able to toil in the fields of linguistic talk.
I've done my time there.
Speaking of linguistic talk, there's a word now that's become commonplace, which has to do with gender and power, mansplaining.
Yes. I'm not sure, you know, that word is not too mellifluous, but maybe it shouldn't be. And yeah, this is one of the things that I would call gender harassment rather than sexual harassment. And I've argued that gender harassment is quite possibly more dangerous and more needing opposition than the sexual harassment that we've been talking about. Gender harassment is the kind of thing where people will interrupt ruthlessly, will mansplain, will tell you what you really mean, dear, will hyper-interpret what you mean because women can't make sense on their own. A lot of these things are linguistic. Other parts of them are, being touched, not sexually, but inappropriately, the pat on the head. You know, the inappropriate, it bothers me when women are first named and men are not. So you get a lot of Hillary versus Trump thing, which makes the man more serious and more universal in a way, more of us rather than just you. So this is gender harassment. It puts women in their place as subordinates and not having a right to engage in the public discourse. And this is another thing we have to start working on.
Remember when Senator Barbara Boxer scolded that Rear Admiral for calling her ma'am?
Yes.
And not calling her senator, or not calling her even Mrs. Boxer, I guess, but ma'am.
Ma'am is tricky. I think, remember that bit at the beginning of, was it The Queen, where Tony Blair is going to see Queen Elizabeth for the first time as prime minister, and he's instructed by his equerry, whatever that is, when you meet her, the first time you speak to her, you say, Your Majesty. The second time, it's ma'am. It's not ma'am. It's not mom. It's mom. You have to aim right for the center. Very tricky. You're in big trouble if you don't.
Well, again, we're talking to Robin Lakoff. Her new book is Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power. And when we return, we'll hear your thoughts, and we do want to hear them. You can join us again by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Robin Lakoff. She's professor emerita in the linguistics department at UC Berkeley, author of Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power. And we're going to bring our callers and listeners into this. Just have to ask Robin, though, about she's quoting Cicero to me. How often do you get somebody quoting Cicero to you during a break? The idea of what's happened to the word friend, because of Facebook, I used to think it was a sacred word almost. You know, you have, my dad said, you're lucky if you have a handful of real friends in your life.
But
Cicero's meaning maybe is coming back into in other words, the idea of a friend is somebody who can do something for you?
Yeah, I mean, Cicero said this in his essay on friendship, which is a very interesting piece of writing. And, that was how a Roman man, we have no idea what Roman women thought because we have no specimens of their writing at this period. But that's what Cicero said, a friend is someone who can do something for you. And today we say, no, that's terrible. That's very, what's the word I want, but it's not a good thing.
Using people, manipulating them.
Manipulative, yeah. And using. You don't want to think of friends like that. If I said to my friend, I want to be friends with you because you can do things for me, well, that would be the end of that friendship. And to us contemporaneously today, it ought to be. But then, as you point out, the use of friend, both as a noun and a verb in the Facebook world, has caused us, I think, to change what we mean by friendship. I think what I mean is some sort of real intimacy in the sense of I trust you, I know something about you, and you about me, and we can therefore have a certain kind of conversation, and I can put certain kinds of hopes in you and you in me, because that's how I feel about you, and it's about feeling. Where I think if I sort of have a very superficial presence on Facebook, I never use it hardly. But if I had Facebook friends, I mostly wouldn't think of them that way unless they happened to be my regular friends. So certainly there's a very new usage, which seems a little manipulative. You use your friends to sell your book. Hey, Facebook friends, be sure to buy Context Counts. Buy many copies, many, many. You know, that's not friendship to me.
It's good promotion, though, for you. Yeah. Let me bring our callers into this, and we go first to Liz. Liz, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much. I can't wait to buy the book. It sounds absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for the show. I'm wondering if you could talk about when people take a word and claim it for their own and change the meaning. Mm. And I'm thinking about when Hillary Clinton called people deplorables, and then they claimed it and have been wearing it proudly ever since.
Well, reclamation is a useful skill. And
African-Americans have done that with the N-word.
You know, Yankee Doodle is a reclamation of a lot of the words in our Yankee Doodle came to town riding on a pony and so on, were reclamations of British talk about how dumb and stupid the colonists were. So it has a long history. African-Americans reclaimed black from being an impolite word to a good word. Women have reclaimed woman. I talked about that in Language and Woman's Place about 5 centuries ago. People have reclaimed, people with disabilities have reclaimed words like cripple. And I think it's a good thing to be able to reclaim when it's appropriate, because it puts the person who was previously put down by language, it gives that person and those people the right and the ability to use language to gain and claim appropriate strength. Now, as for deplorables, you know, I agree, knowing what has happened in the year that has passed since then, I agree with Hillary Clinton that quite a few of Trump's base who voted for him, I think it was done in many cases, if not most, for deplorable reasons, which have to do with racism and misogyny and nativism and so on.
Let me thank the caller, Liz. Some pushback here from a listener who tweets, your guest is the unfortunate face of the new left, getting offended at everything possible. She complains about Hillary being first named compared to Trump, but she conveniently forgets about Bernie and Jeb.
That's true. And I don't think Jeb is first named regularly, nor even Bernie with a regularity. And by the way, if I were the face of the new left, why wouldn't I'd be talking about Bernie?
He was called Bernie, and Elvis was called Elvis.
Yeah. If you get famous enough, but why?
Oprah's called Oprah.
Yes. It's partly a characteristic of fame, celebrity. Partly, I think, in the case of Hillary Clinton, it's in order to be sure to differentiate her from her husband. You know, you can't, when you talk just about Clinton, maybe there's the possibility of a misunderstanding there. But it does diminish, and it creates a false intimacy. I don't think it has that much to do with my being a member of the new left. I'm not sure I'm a member. How do you get to be? I'm not a card-carrying. I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU, yes, I am. But I am not a card-carrying member of anything called the new left.
Well, if
don't,
there's
don't
someone
presume. From you're, that... you're mansplaining me. You're telling me who I am. Don't.
Someone from that organization who may call you and ask you to join, they have an opportunity now. But Janice wants to know, do you think the word racist has been used too casually or imprecisely of late?
Well, again, that's hard, because what is one person's racist term is just somebody else's racial differentiation. But I think we should retain some sensitivity to the idea that there are people who will be hurt if you're not careful. In the old days, we didn't used to worry about those people. They didn't have worrying rights. I'm kind of glad that we have to be more careful these days. Sensitivity to others' needs is not a bad thing.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Benjamin joins us next. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much. I look forward to reading your book. My question is relates to the way we use language and how we can what do you think is a good way that we can overcome the divisive nature of labeling as it relates to like derogatory terms and acronyms that are used by different groups as we start to shrink in culture and people use language to identify ourselves? How can we maintain that stability moving forward?
I think one thing we have to learn to do is be more careful. So we ourselves, you know, if we discover one way or another that we're using a term or have used a term that is bothersome to people, well, question one is why is it bothersome? I think if I talk about misogyny, that annoys a whole lot of people. But I'm going to use it anyway because I think it refers to something very real in our world, alas. But if people say, you know, I wish you wouldn't use this word to describe people like me, I am going to think about it, and I am going to be, if necessary, more careful. I think this is part of our job as the species with language, that because language makes us who and what we are, we owe it to language to give something back to it. That is our careful usage. So we need to be careful about our own use of language, and then we need to be careful about how other people use language and not necessarily criticize them overtly. We don't have to do that. But think if somebody is continually using language in a way that could be dangerous, I can't think of anyone like that, but suppose I could. It's my job to not support them no matter what else wonderful stuff I think they might be doing. So it's your job to kind of watch out for language and protect it and its users.
That protection and that challenge can be very strong in light of, let me ask you about this, in fact. There's a lot of fluidity now with pronouns, with gender pronouns, because there are so many people who don't identify as being with either gender, and so they insist on being called they, let's say, or not using the he and the she, which is so ingrained in the language that as sensitive as you might be and as much as caring and wanting to do the right thing, it's difficult.
We live in difficult times, particularly linguistically difficult times. And if you don't like it, well, you know, I think Elon Musk is preparing a journey to Mars. You should take the first available one because this is the way language is going to be for us. And we got to get used to it. But maybe more importantly, what was I going to say?
Well, actually, I'm right on point here with a comment from a woman listener named Pamela who says, well, my grandchildren, now 2 and 3, were babies, and people would ask me, boy or girl, I would answer, we'll see.
Yeah, and absolutely right. And, you know, this is interesting because the problem of pronouns, and specifically and only the third person singular English personal pronoun is the only one that gives us any trouble ever. We were worrying about this in a slightly different context when I wrote Language in Woman's Place, which was, oh God, it's coming up on 50 years ago. Wow. Horrible. Then the concern was, how are we going to deal with the so-called neutral masculine? You know, will everyone please take his seat in a mixed audience?
Chairperson.
Well, this was chairman, which was supposed to stand for everybody.
Well, so was man, supposed
to stand
for everybody.
The universal, all men are created equal, all of that. And women argued that we might be being told that that was gender neutral, but we sensed it as not. We sensed all men are created equal as a subtle statement that women weren't. You could understand chairman as that only men could hold this position properly. And so there were all, back in the 70s, there were many forms of pronoun that were offered in substitution for his and her. V and HSE and Z and a raft of others. I said at the time, this is not going to happen. And just as Michael has just said, pronouns are too deeply embedded in the grammar of the language rather than being like full nouns, kind of consciously thought up and used.
Sort of that way with Ms. too, wasn't it? It just never ignited.
Well, Ms. had another peculiar problem. People kept saying, well, you know, I love to say Ms., but my tongue is such a, I can't pronounce it. And this is very reminiscent of what, about a decade earlier, you were hearing from Southern bigoted politicians when they were being instructed by their mentors not to use the very bad N-word, and they weren't going to say Negro, which was the polite term, because they didn't want to sound polite to those people for their white constituents. Remember, the Voting Rights Act had not yet been passed. So that was, that changed all of a sudden a few years later. But meanwhile, they constructed the word Negra. And when asked, why, if you can say Negro, why can't you be polite and say Negro? Oh, my poor, thick Southern tongue just can't get around those vowels. Oh, sure. And similarly, people say, oh, I can't pronounce Ms. Well, you know, can you, what's the first, what's the diminutive of the first name of Richard Burton's husband, wife? Liz. Oh, you can say Liz, but Ms. is too much. And what about the term of respect for a married woman? What's that? Mrs. Well, that's twice as hard as Ms. Why can't, you know, why can't, can you say that and you can't say Ms.? Now, why you can't say it, it's the same sort of thing that make certain kinds of people talk about women being shrill, which is taking a phonetic term and applying it, meaning unpleasant sounding in literal phonetics, and applying it to unpleasant sounding because a woman is saying something at all or something I don't want to hear. So similarly, Ms. is unpronounceable because it changes the status of women relative to men, which I don't want to deal with. And well, similarly, he and she, you know, having to make that distinction made the gender distinction much more relevant than it should have been in any reasonable world. So people fight.
You reminded me of a hilarious bit that Lenny Bruce did many years ago, of course, Lyndon Johnson trying to say the word Negro, and he just couldn't do it. But I want to ask back, get to some more callers here, but the caller's initial question was how he can do something to bridge the divide or overcome, you know, the sense of distance, whether it's between men and women or whether it's between Democrats and Republicans. And in your work through the years, you've pointed out something that I think is really of great importance to help across the divide. And that, and well, that's a couple of things. Listen, first of all, that people need to listen more. Hemingway said most people don't listen. He was right about that, wrong about many things, but right about that. And you don't have to always prove that you are right. And that's a part of listening, too.
That's right, although I am very bad at that because I'm always right. This just happens to be a fact in the world that is directly provable. But otherwise, yeah, again, this is all part of the same thing, that we should try to be nice and polite and civil to each other, regardless of, you know, what our color is or our gender is or our political stance is. If we could listen, in the first thing, and respond in a courteous fashion, which doesn't mean total agreement.
Respectful.
Yeah. You know, just say, I hear what you're saying. I don't agree with it for this reason. And it's much better to give reason than just say, oh, you're such a stupid idiot. You know, that's not an argument. And we have to learn in this world, we have to learn to do it or we are lost.
Here's Ariane. Ariane, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Hello, Robin Lakoff, I'm so happy to talk to you. I want to thank you. I was your student in American languages at UC Berkeley 20 years ago.
Yes.
And it was one of perhaps the most influential course in my academic, professional, and personal life.
Wow.
I remember many of your lectures well. I remember, and as a Spanish high school teacher at a public school in San Mateo, I actually incorporate many of the lessons into a unit I've developed on languages and identity in Spanish, but for advanced Spanish speakers and advanced Spanish learners. And a couple of the projects that we do are, one is everybody has to share an experience of linguistic prejudice that either they or a family member has experienced in their life, and we share those anonymously, and we analyze them. We analyze society through the lens of the different types of prejudices that are coming up. And we also do a whole linguistic background, like a linguistic story, where we talk about all the languages and dialects and accents that have influenced the different ways in which we speak and communicate in our different communities. And I just want to thank you. I feel like your work continues in different ways, that it was really inspirational for me, and many of my students really enjoy this whole linguistic unit I do.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you both for your comment and for the work you do, which I think is tremendously important and insightful and, helps your students and others greatly. I should say sort of parenthetically, because I am hereby going to Kfil. And as a Jewish mother, my son and daughter-in-law and my two grandchildren are all fully fluent in Spanish and English, and I am so delighted.
Well, not everybody's, accustomed to Yiddish words. Kfil is when you feel pride.
Yes.
And thank you for that call.
You can only Kfil. Let's see, people may know this better than I do, because I know exactly 10 words of Yiddish. But you can Kfil for your own DNA. I can Kfil for my son with no problem at all.
I think you can Kfil for a friend, too.
Can I Kfil for a daughter-in-law?
Absolutely.
Certainly want to. I do. Then I hereby Kfil for Daniela. Absolutely.
Doesn't have to be blood. You can Kfil for a friend, I think, too.
They have to be a part of your intimate world, I think.
Exactly.
I do that.
But that last caller mentioned dialect, and I'm looking at a question from a listener named Laura who wants to know. She says, I've always been perplexed in a way about dialects and how they form. Can your guest explain why languages evolve into various dialects that are sometimes vastly different than the original language, Yiddish being a good example?
Yeah, well, Yiddish is actually a dialect. It's Middle High German. That's right. Yiddish is a dialect of German. There was somebody many years ago who tried to argue in an official linguistics publication that Yiddish was not Germanic, that it was a dialect of Hebrew.
I'm sorry. I can't resist a great joke. Esperanto was a language where people wanted to be a universal language. People like George Bernard Shaw became Esperanto followers and so forth.
Yes.
The Esperanto Convention, they all spoke one language, Yiddish.
Yes, exactly. But, and it's clearly not true. Yiddish has a great many Hebrew borrowings lexically, but that doesn't make it Hebrew. We sort of have to deal with that. But dialect. Okay. Dialects arise typically when you have speakers of a single language, but they are separated geographically or socially or in some other way. So if we have a group of, let's say, speakers of English, and a bunch of them get on a boat and they sail across a wide ocean and form their own colonies, late 17th century, British people, Englishmen, who were making the trip over to visit the colonists, were already grumbling that the colonists weren't talking properly. In other words, that American English was evolving in its own right to be a dialect of English, as was British English. So dialects arise when there is some kind of distinction, when there isn't a lot of interchange between speakers, hence African-American English, because it arose when African-American speakers and white speakers of American English didn't talk a lot to each other.
Is that the same as Ebonics?
It is, but if you want to call it Ebonics, you can call it Ebonics. I don't care. Then the next thing that happens is that it often is the case that one group of speakers of one dialect have more power and prestige than another. And this will then the fact that they speak differently in certain ways will be used by certain kinds of people to argue for the superiority of the higher people. And we've certainly seen that in the case of Black English, you know, entirely incorrectly, by the way, of course. We have seen it. Now, the case of men and women is sort of interesting because men and women always hang out together, and yet we speak in very different ways. So how the differences between the way men talk and the way women talk, and not just in English, but in every language I've heard anything about of this kind, the difference isn't exactly a dialectal one. It has arisen for other reasons that we need it. We find it necessary to make distinctions between between men and women in every way we can, which, you know, is one of the things we need to fight against.
It's also power, though. I'm looking at a quote sent to us by a listener named Rajiz, who writes, "Language is a mask of conquest."
Yes, absolutely.
Let's bring some more of our callers aboard here. Oh, but before I do, I want to read a question from a listener tweeted in. Omar says, "If Trump's use of language is so problematic, why does it resonate and land with so much of the populace? What does it say about our collective degradation of language?"
Well, or I think it says more about our collective degradation of ourselves, that some of us have become people that might not, you know, look at being human in the best way, who find it useful to make divisions and distinctions rather than bringing together. Trump encourages divisiveness. He encourages looking down at people who are not Christian white males, native-born. This is exactly what we don't need in the 21st century and beyond. And Trump's use of language gives, because he's president, however he uses language becomes more prestigious and becomes more acceptable. This is, you know, one of the real problems of Trump talk, that it makes things that until recently, even if you thought them, most people had the decency not to say them aloud. And it makes those things acceptable. And, you know, it's necessary not to encourage that kind of talk because it represents a kind of thought. And people who do prefer to think that way should not be encouraged. And that's what we're doing.
And here's Georgie. Georgie, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Sure.
Yeah, Georgie, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Dr. Lakoff, first of all, I want to say thank you so much for all your work. I'm familiar with it. I'm an English teacher, and I speak language.
Georgie, your line is terrible. I'm not really hearing you, and I don't think Robin is either. But she wanted to know about body language, thoughts about gender differences with body language.
Yes.
Sorry, Georgie.
And again, that's very interesting because one of the things that you often hear people say is don't talk with your hands, you know, that somehow the use of extra linguistic functions, behaviors is lower than the pure use of language, of verbal language proper. And this is wrong. Because it's so hard to communicate effectively, we should use whatever communicative devices we have been given. And that means not just the word itself, the linguistics, but the paralinguistics, intonation, that is, speed of articulation, precision of speech, and much more. And extra linguistics, our gestures, how close we stand, how we move, and so on. And the notion that extra-linguistic or talk, communication or body language is somehow a sign of not being a good communicator, I would take strong exception to that. Now, there are a couple of reasons why people have said that. One is that, well, you know, animals can do body language. You know, the cat twitches its ears and wags its tail to show it's not happy with you. They also do paralinguistic stuff, but they don't exactly have words, so words must be a higher thing. No, it's a different thing. And secondly, because I think women are more likely to be users of para and extra linguistics and more effective users of them. Because para and extra linguistic communication is what we use most often to encode emotional response, which women tend to be more adept at and more willing to use. And therefore, anything women do more than men do tends to get a bad press. This is something, you know, totally incorrect. And in fact, I would encourage everyone to be using every communicative device available to us to avoid misunderstanding, which we ought to try to avoid doing. So, yeah, up with, you know, put your arms up, like I'm doing here on the radio, for nonverbal and extra linguistic forms of language. So, you know, let's do it.
One of these days, I'd love to have you back talking about the subtextual nature of language, or just how we can keep up with the changes of language. But it's always enlightening to have you. I appreciate your being with us. Thank you.
Oh, goodness.
Robin Lakoff, again, is Professor Emerita in the Linguistics Department, UC Berkeley. Her book is out, and it's available, and it is well worth reading. It's called Context Counts, Papers on Language, Gender, and Power. Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you on the morrow. Stay with us on KQED Radio. I'm Michael Kreskin.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.